When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Chris D from the Flesh Eaters, and you're listening to Deeper Digs in Rock.
DIY and How Studios presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Hello, diggers. Welcome to another edition of Deeper Digs in Rock. Christian Swain here. I am the rock and roll archaeologist, and we are back in Aftermaster Studios in Hollywood. Hey, by the way, if you haven't already, do take a look at these amazing studios right in the heart of La La Land. Just go to aftermaster.com. All right, this week's news. So if you haven't been paying attention to the podcast feeds, we have begun pulling shows out of our big pipe and giving them their very own feeds. Right now, you can find this show, Deeper Digs in Rock, as a standalone feed for your listening pleasure. And of course, there is always the big daddy, the one that started it all, the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcast. That, too, is available on its own. So if some of you are dedicated to just that show or this one, there they are for you. Of course, the Big Pipe with all the shows will always be there for the dedicated digger. All right, that's the headlines, finally, and this is the one that matters most to us. If you enjoy what we do here, then please, please, please tell a friend about rock and roll archaeology. You don't know how much that helps. Thank you. All right, that takes care of the housekeeping. So let's meet today's guest.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder.
How many of you out there in Podland actually know what Kodachrome is? Okay, how many of you have taken a roll of film from Kodak and put it in a camera, closed it up, and shot 12, 24, 36 frames, and then do it over again? Any of you developed the film in a darkroom and then made prints? How about snuck a camera into a concert back when, on all tickets it was printed, no cameras allowed? How about hundreds of times, and with, like, telephoto lenses and stuff? Well, that is what our special guest today did for a time back when rock and roll was king. Our guest is Julian David Stone. Now, today he's an author and filmmaker, but when he was a young man in college, he was an outlaw photographer. And he's just released a beautiful coffee table book with some of the most exciting shots he took in that short career. Titled No Cameras Allowed, My Career as an Outlaw Photographer, 1981 to 1987, from our friends at Duration Press. So, let's sit down with Julian and get these stories on some of the iconic performers and harrowing adventures he took to shoot them. Ladies and gentlemen, Julian David Stone.
Yeah. snapshot and it froze without a sign.
Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, Julian Stone. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, we are excited to have you here. It's a very interesting book. It's a little bit different than a lot of the guests that we've talked to because you're not really a photographer of rock and roll music anymore, right? That's not what you do.
No. This was a period of my life where I was very much a photographer of rock and roll back in the 1980s. And it was about a 5-6 year period where it was all I did and I was obsessed with it. And then I kind of hung it up in about 1987.
Mm-hmm. So let's get a little bit of your background. You grew up in the Bay Area, is that right?
That's correct.
And then migrated down to the warmer climes of Southern California.
Yeah, I came down here to go to California Institute of the Arts to study filmmaking, and mm-hmm. I've pretty much been here since about 18 or 19 years old, but I'm back up in the Bay Area, and I'm not exaggerating, about at least 20 times a year because I still have family.
Families up there and that sort of thing. Right.
So the Highway 5 is like just a long driveway for me pretty much at this mm-hmm, point.
Mm-hmm. So how did you become an artist? I mean, Cal Arts is, that's you're only allowed to go there if you're an artist.
I loved photography. I loved filmmaking. I loved music, rock and roll, and all of it. And that was just the school that I ended up at. I can't remember exactly, but I do know that a couple of people who were in high school with me ended up at Cal Arts. And mm-hmm. I wasn't particularly close with them, but they were sort of the well-known figures in the artier students at my high school, and so I sort of followed them. So that's kind of how
They ended up going.
Yeah, okay. They were animators. Actually, it was two guys, and they've done very well. One of them directed The Lion King back in 1993, Rob Minkoff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He went to my high school, and another guy named Kirk Wise directed Beauty and the Beast. And the two of them were kind of the art studs, if there is such a thing in high school.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, they're going to Cal Arts? I'll go to Cal Arts.
Right. But you don't do really photography today. You're more of a filmmaker, right?
Yeah, it's like I said, even during when a lot of this was going on, I was studying filmmaking and doing the rock photography on the side. And then it reached a point where the rock photography was actually was exploding.
We'll talk about that as we go through the story.
But, yeah, and I didn't have time to do both, and I had to choose, and I chose filmmaking, and that's been the last 20, 30 years, and sometimes I'm not sure if I made the right choice, but...
So. Well, we all have those sort of paths those crossroads that we look back and go, what if I had taken the other path?
Yeah.
Right. I getcha. Music seems to have always been a part of you in your soul.
Absolutely.
But you're not a musician, right?
No, and that's kind of how the photography started. I wanted to be a rock star like a lot of, pretty much every kid wants to be. And
yours truly included. So, yeah.
Well, with me, it lasted about 5 seconds after I picked up a guitar and realized I had no musical talent. And I could not, it's going to sound funny, who's someone who loves music so much, I could not play consistently a note. Like, I couldn't tell the difference. Like I remember it's in the book, and it was actually a French horn where I was trying to play it in class, and the teacher said, got infuriated and said, sometimes you can play it right and sometimes you can play it wrong, and I couldn't tell the difference. Like I was playing it the same each time and my ear couldn't hear the difference. And so that combined with, like I said, picking up a guitar and realizing this wasn't going to happen, I sort of moved into the photography became my way into rock and roll.
So let's get our younger diggers, our fans, we call them the diggers, an understanding of what the camera policies used to be before everyone had a smartphone at a concert.
You could not bring them in.
It used to say on the tickets, no cameras allowed.
Yep, no cameras allowed. Some had it posted on the walls. I mean, as you would get closer to security, they'd have a whole list of contraband, and cameras were definitely one of them. And also to give a context, the cameras, particularly that I was bringing in, these were big cameras. This was 35 millimeter. It wasn't a little tiny, digital camera or even a point.
You had to actually stick film in it, things like that.
Yeah, you had
to have a body that could, hold a roll of film and all of that. And then you had various lenses that you had to change out to get different perspectives, right?
Exactly. Multiple lenses, multiple rolls of film. I mean, just bringing in 15 or 20 rolls of film so you could shoot 300 pictures, that took up a lot of space. You know, today a digital card will take thousands of photos.
Right. Yeah, of course, you know, or anybody over 30 listening to this is going, right. We know. Yeah, I miss those days, you know.
Right.
So, but yeah, no cameras allowed, right?
That was the policy.
This was, and to do so was, you know, putting your life at risk.
Yeah, definitely your well-being. Let's put it that way. You know, I don't know if you really get killed.
Okay, but I over-exaggerated a little.
No, but it felt that way. I mean, you know, when I was running from roadies, or there were moments of where's this going to end?
So. I'm sure there were plenty of looks from the stage of like, who the fuck is that guy, and why does he have a camera out there?
Yeah, I was actually shooting. I'll sort of just jump ahead to a story, but I was shooting Bonnie Hayes and the Wild Combo. If you remember them, they didn't last a long time. Mm-hmm. Bonnie Hayes ended up like sort of going joining Melissa Etheridge's band or something. But okay. they had a little bit of a run as a band and a couple of, I think, one top 40 hit. And they were actually, it was a band that occasionally someone would come to town who didn't care about cameras. So I took a camera in with a flash. I figure I'll take advantage of this since they don't care. And I remember using this flash from the stage and sort of like, or from the audience and blasting the stage at a certain point. And there's a picture of it in the book. The lead singer or the lead guitarist came over and just kind of stood over me and stared down like, enough with the flash. We can't see anymore up here.
Yeah. The lights are for you.
Exactly.
All right. First night of guerrilla photography. And just to remind everybody again, no cameras allowed. My career is an outlaw rock and roll photographer, 81 to 87. So our first night, guerrilla photography, was April 28th, 1983. Tell us about that night.
Sure. So like I said, I was obsessed with rock and roll and discovered I was not going to be the next Eric Clapton and was really into photography. So I thought this will be my way into the world. And the Ramones were coming to town, and I love the Ramones, so I figured, well, this is it. I'll go down there, I'll shoot the Ramones, and this will be what I'll try to do now to be part of rock and roll. So I show up at the club, camera bag over my shoulder.
Oh, you thought...
Oh, I thought I'm just going to walk.
I'm a photographer.
Yeah,
do I get my pass?
It wasn't even a pass. I just figured I'd walk in and take pictures. I didn't know it was any different than going to the county fair, any other place you might see a concert. So I just thought I was going to walk in, and a guard just stopped me and laughed at me and pointed at a sign that said "No cameras allowed" and said "Get out of here." And I went back to my car, and I was about to dump the equipment in, and I went, there's got to be a way around this. And fortunately, this being the 80s, I had a nice, wonderful pair of tube socks, and I quickly shoved the camera body in one side and one camera lens in the other, a little 50 millimeter lens, and a few rolls of film, and went back. The guard didn't see anything wrong, and I went into the show and went into the bathroom, put everything together, got out as the Ramones hit the stage, and started shooting. And after that, I was just addicted, and over the next 5 or 6 years, I took over 10,000 pictures, almost all of it smuggling in my equipment of all the big bands of the 1980s.
Yeah. Just as these guys are coming up and becoming really well known, which then, after a while, you get a little well known as a photographer. And we'll talk about that in a bit. So the Ramones were the first time that you actually brought that in. You got the excitement of the taboo aspect, plus you came away with some really great shots.
Yeah, I was so happy with the pictures, and just the excitement of pulling it off and the fact that you weren't allowed to do it made it all the more, it was kind of like being my way of being part of the rebellion that is at the heart of rock and roll.
Yeah, that is a big fact. What do you think about that back in the day, these guys and their management were so insistent on, careful crafting of the image. But today, now, everybody's got a smartphone that is taking pictures, and it's now encouraged. So really, would it made it that much of a difference if everybody had brought a camera in back in the day?
Well, it's hard to say, because when the smartphone started, I still go to a lot of concerts. I don't photograph formally. I noticed that they attempted to stop it, like in the, you know, like 07, 08 when the smartphone started. And I remember noticing that they were attempting.
Yeah.
And then they gave up. Now it's ubiquitous. Yeah. Although they don't, you still see shows where if somebody's holding it, where they're obviously filming, that they tend to still go after. Like they don't mind if you're taking pictures.
Okay. So now it's down to the a movie version.
Right. And even that has failed. You see.
Come on. I've seen an entire concert.
Right.
Now, it's not great. I don't understand why, you know, there are some bands, if you remember, the same thing with the recording, you know, famously, you know, there's the Grateful Dead and some of the other jam bands who, you know, have a space specifically for the recorders. You know, granted, bands like that tend to each night be different. And so you're capturing something unique. But I also remember like 20 years ago, where bands would just sell you that night's concert, you know, afterwards. You just go out into the lobby and buy it. So, you know, why wouldn't they do the same thing with film and video? You know, go to their website and you can buy it and then, you know, try to stop anybody from taking pictures. I've been to a few concerts even recently, King Crimson, for example, where they said no photography, period.
Really?
End of story. Yeah. And to me, it wasn't so much of the, oh, geez, you know, we've got to capture the moment. They let everybody pull their cell phones out at the last, like the last number.
Is that what they said?
Go ahead. It was now like, okay, you can do it now. you know, it was just, it didn't interfere with the viewing from the audience. I mean, now with everybody having a camera, it just gets to be really too much. So, all right. So throughout 1983, you got addicted to smuggling a camera into shows and secretly taking shots. Tom Petty, the B-52s, Dave Edmonds. But I want you to talk about an obscure band called Checkered Past with ex-Pistol Steve Jones, Michael DeBar, Clem Burke, and Frank Infante from Blondie. Blondie. Why was that show so special for you?
Oh, my. So
I mean, that's a really obscure band.
Yeah, right? No.
A little bit of a super group, I guess. But
So it's funny because I don't get asked a lot about the pictures of Checkered Past in the book. So this is great. I went to see
them. I am the rock and roll archaeologist.
Well, there
I
you go. Deep. Yeah. And it is a fascinating, you know, group of people from, you know, they were sort of discards from all these bands. And I went to see them, got my camera in. And yeah, this was not a happy bunch of guys. They clearly were sort of in shock at my opinion of sort of playing in this, you know, these were guys who'd been bands playing big arenas and stuff, and there were not a lot of people there, and they didn't seem very happy about it, and they kind of took moments to slam their sort of former bands sort of in euphemistic, you know, terms. And then the biggest memory I have is that at the end of it, sort of trying to be punk rock, they encouraged everybody in the crowd to sort of get up on stage
people were in the audience?
Well, that's what I was going to say. It was about 20 people, so you ended up...
So you can't possibly get everybody up
well,
on stage.
Well, that's what happened, though. Everybody got up on stage with them, and you had the sort of weirdness of them playing their final number in front of an empty club because everybody was on stage with them, and that was sort of the final piece to the whole thing. And yeah, it was quite a show. That I like my pictures, but yeah, they were not happy. they did not seem happy. Like, this was, you know, I just can only imagine, you know, this was Blondie, you know, shortly after Blondie had been a huge band, and obviously the Sex Pistols, and not a happy group of guys.
So also in 1983, you discover what would become another lifelong addiction to you, the Grateful Dead?
Yeah, actually, I think that comes the next year, but I think I might have seen my first Garcia band show, but it was...
Oh, well, I think it was
Garcia. Yeah, I saw Garcia, which was...
Jerry band, yeah.
Yeah, it was about 2 years later when I finally had that experience of going, oh my God, this is what I need to do now, see this band as much as possible.
Yeah.
So that came a couple years later, but I did see Garcia band and got some pictures I'm really happy with from seeing Jerry and enjoyed it, but it didn't stick the way it did, ironically, when I finally saw the Grateful Dead. I saw both Bobby and Jerry.
Bobby and the Midnights, right?
Yeah. I saw Bobby and the Midnights and Jerry separately before I actually saw the Dead and enjoyed those, but it really, you know, it's that whole experience of the crowd and going with a group of friends, and you don't necessarily get that with the smaller bands, but you do, or, you know, with Jerry band or with Bobby, but you do when you see the Grateful Dead.
I completely understand. It took me a couple of shows to kind of understand what this whole thing was about.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the first time I'm like, why are they tuning in between every song? That's, and then you come to realize, oh, they're not really tuning. They're really actually having a conversation on what song they're going to do next.
Right.
Oh, that's genius.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the crowd that harkens back to, the 60s.
Yeah.
And especially as a kid from the 80s, you know, you're like, oh, my God, it's.
This is great.
It's Woodstock. It's Haight Ashbury. Oh, you know, right here enclosed. So I can understand. So are you still a Dead
oh,
fan?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I've
have you seen like the various incarnations since Jerry's passing?
Absolutely. In fact, I with the Grateful Dead because we were in California. I didn't really go very far because you didn't have to.
No,
you
know,
you
could see every couple of months.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, or you know, between Southern and Northern California, or even going to Vegas. In 2001, I followed Phil Lesh and friends all around the country. I kind of dropped out. I sort of burned out on the film business for a little bit. We're jumping way ahead, but I went for about 2 months and followed them, and that was just fantastic because obviously it wasn't near on the scale of the Grateful Dead.
So that was your midlife crisis.
That's what I told people. I said, that's what I do. I go follow the remnants of the Grateful Dead around the country.
Yeah. So how many shows did you shoot during that period? Grateful Dead shows.
Well, I didn't. I saw a lot. I saw about 110 Grateful Dead shows.
Oh,
with
actually,
Jerry.
I think in the book, you very quickly don't shoot. You like
well.
You,
what that sort of all came towards the end, where it was around the same combination of stuff. Where I was I was in film school now, and I was having troubles as the rock and roll career was taking off. I needed to be studying film, and they wanted me to shoot shows in L.A. And I had discovered the Grateful Dead, and I shot them the first couple of times, and then I just wanted to put the equipment down and dance.
Yeah.
And so so there's a lot of Grateful Dead shows where I didn't photograph, and obviously the farther along, you know, the less I photographed. I just wanted to go with my friends and dance and do the rest of what you do at a Grateful Dead concert.
So you also got to travel to Europe and shoot U2 in hometown Dublin, just as they're rising into what they now are, you know, the superstar band. But this is just as they're really in the hockey stick moment.
Yeah, this is 83. I went to Europe and I went over to see them in Ireland, and it was kind of an Irish homecoming. They hadn't played in about a year back in Ireland, and it was just after the War album had come out and they had started to become international superstars, and they came back and played this show, and it was very emotional. I swear I was the only American in the crowd. And it was the Edge's birthday. They brought a cake out on stage. I mean, very much a hometown show, and it felt like the return of the conquering heroes.
Yeah.
So it was very, very powerful show. And it was an amazing lineup because it was also Simple Minds, the Eurythmics, Steel Pulse. It was just a great lineup of other bands with U2 at the very top of the lineup.
Yeah, that must have been surreal.
Oh, it was fantastic. And randomly, when I was putting the book together, I was trying to narrow down. For some reason, I didn't have my tickets in front of me the day of the show, so I Googled the show, and a Facebook page came up that was devoted. It was called Classic Dublin Gigs, and in it, I found pictures from some of the professional photographers who had shot from the stage, and I found myself in the audience.
Really?
Yeah, I actually found a picture. I was looking at it. I called my wife over, and I said, come here. I said, that's me in the
Does
crowd.
Does it show you with a camera?
You sort of see the camera strap over my shoulder, but it's definitely me.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was really fine to find this sort of evidence, you know, all these years later of me in the crowd.
Yeah, you ended up being there solo, but I don't think you went to Europe solo.
Oh, I did. I
thought there was a couple of people that you roomed with.
Well, I was supposed to go with a friend, and he canceled at the last minute. So I went by myself, and I met these two guys on the train from the airport.
Americans.
Americans who had flown in. I think they'd been on the same flight, who had flown in, and we decided had flown into London to get a room together. And we did that, and they were kind of an interesting pair. One of them had come over to look for a girl he was in love with, immediately found that she wasn't at the restaurant that was the only address he had, and so he got on the next plane and went back. And then the other
she gave him a fake phone number, and he flew all the way to Europe to go and find her. Wow.
Or I think
kind of romantic, kind of dumb.
I got the sense it was like an ex-girlfriend, and she wasn't at the address anymore. And then there, it's not the internet, or there was no way to cut it. And then the other guy was going to be in London for a couple of days and was on his way to Germany to study linguistics. And as I write in the book, he stuttered, which I found very surreal. That, but
it's a way to get over. All power to the people. Right?
Yeah, no, it was fine, but it was just a funny juxtaposition that's what he had chosen as his career, and
and you end up in Dublin for the big show.
Right.
I'm sure you shot pictures around London.
Oh, I did.
The great
yeah,
rock and roll history that you find.
And there were there's no pictures in the book of it, but I also saw Dave Edmonds in London. I'd seen him previously in San Francisco, but there was he played a little tiny place in London called the Red Lion Pub or something, and I got to see him there too while I was there, and that was great. And I bought so many records because this is obviously way before the internet, and they just had all these wonderful record shops. They all seemed to be below street level, and I ended up, I amassed such a collection of rare stuff that I was finding. I had a bag at Victoria Station that I would go out, collect all my stuff, go back, get it out of the baggage clip, put more records in it, and then put it back in the baggage check because I just couldn't. It was too heavy to carry
right,
to my
right,
hotel.
And just until you had that flight to get home.
Exactly.
Right. So was there much of a difference in how the security treated you in America versus in Europe for those shows?
I remember it was pretty easy to get into the U2 show. That was another thing that I figured out, that when you shot a big show, there were pluses and minuses, and the plus was the security, just because they were overwhelmed dealing with large crowds, they didn't give you near as thorough a pat down, and by then I'd gotten pretty good with how to hide stuff. The minus was getting close enough to take the pictures you wanted was harder, because these were people, more hardcore fans, people who'd been in some cases, if it was a big show, had been waiting all night. So you had to really fight to get your real estate. And some people would kind of give you a dirty look as they saw you sort of, doing that thing of inching up to the front.
Yeah. So I'm one of those guys.
Yeah,
I know. Oh, man. So the Police, Talking Heads, Elvis Costello, Joan Jett, David Bowie on Sirius Moonlight. That is a lot of high fuel concerts in 1983.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I was busy, and it's that wonderful thing of being a teenager that's obsessed. It's your whole life, and you have basically no other responsibilities.
So, what's your favorite memory of all that?
Of that year,
of
particular,
that year. Yeah.
Probably the European stuff was that trip in Europe was pretty special.
Yeah.
Although the police at Shea Stadium was pretty magical too, because they were,
huge. It's like trying to recreate the Beatles in Shea Stadium and all that.
When I put the book together and started dealing with all these images and started talking about it on the internet, by far those pictures had the biggest reaction, because apparently that show. In their careers was after that they decided to break up the Police after Shea Stadium, because they were kind of like, where do we go from here? We just sold out, Shea Stadium. So I had a lot of people reaching out to me who wanted to see more of the pictures, because I have a lot of them of the Police. So that was interesting to discover that the importance of that gig to people who were fans of the Police.
Right. So did you trade through fanzines how did they know? Oh, just these were friends. At college, right?
Oh, no. I'm talking about this is now. So much of this project, when I stopped doing it in 87, this was just an archive that I carried around for 30 years, and by the grace of God survived, because there were a lot of dorm room moves and a lot of...
Yeah, these are tangible. This is actual film that you have to put in a box and carry it to wherever the next home is.
Oh, yeah, I had
to move. And it's not like just on your computer.
No, I mean, in the early 80s, I had a friend sort of do a down and dirty scan of everything. And then obviously everything was rescanned for the book. But up until the early, about 10, 15 years ago, this stuff was just negatives that I was carrying around. And thank God there wasn't a flood. So
now you're a freshman at CalArts. You moved down to Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the darlings of MTV, the band that seemingly was made in a laboratory just for that channel, and that's Duran Duran.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is kind of a long, crazy story, but I was not a huge fan of Duran Duran. But, I knew them, and, I was interested in anything going on with music.
But all the girls were a huge fan of Duran Duran.
And one guy who I knew at Cal Arts was obsessed with him. Uh-huh. I mean, I can't even describe, you would not believe the obsession. So he came to me and he knew I took photos. And he said, look, I'll pay for the tickets. I'll pay for the gas, the car, everything. Will you go down and see Duran Duran with me and take pictures? I'm like, well, what do I got to lose? So we get down there, and this is the Forum in early 1984. And like you said, yeah, it's just
a fabulous Forum.
Yeah. And it's just pandemonium. You know, Duran Duran is at their peak with screaming girls. There's no tickets to be found anywhere. So we find one usher at the Forum who says basically, hey, give me $50. I'll open a door and you guys will go. We give him $50. We go into the show and we don't have seats. So we're kind of milling around and I've got my equipment and I'm keeping it hidden. The lights go down. The screaming gets louder if possible. And I pull out my camera and I start taking pictures as they're performing. So I'm shooting away, and the plan is to shoot some pictures from here and then move closer. Well, we're a couple songs in, and all of a sudden I feel this hand on my back, and I turn around, and there's two huge security guards standing there, and they look at me and go, Duran Duran, group security, can you please come with me? So they grab me, they start to haul me out of the arena. My friend, like out of a cartoon, just disappears in a puff of smoke. He's
of course,
gone.
Yeah.
He wants no part of this.
Yeah. So, I am not getting in trouble, and goddammit, I want to see Duran Duran.
Right. So they take me outside, they rip open my camera, they take the film, they take everything. Now, by then, I had already gotten into the habit, after I shot a roll, of putting it in my shoe, a finished roll. So I had one roll that did survive. That's why there is a picture in the book of Duran Duran. So they take everything from me and give me back my equipment. Now they kind of loosen up. They realize I'm just a kid. I'm not, you know, I'm not really looking.
You're not really the nefarious type that's going to print a million copies and send it out throughout the world.
So so they decide I can go back into the show. So they I'm outside the arena. They take me up to a door. They knock on the door. The door opens and it's the same guy that we had paid to get into the show. He sees me standing there with two security guards, thinks
I've ratted
on him. So he freaks out and he's trying to get the door shut. And, you know, and the security guys have no idea what's going on. And, you know, and I know exactly what's going on. So this guy won't let us in and he slams the door and the two security guys are standing there and they start to have a conversation. What are we going to do with this guy? Well, one of them suggests let's take him back in through the backstage area.
Awesome.
So I'm like,
this
is looking good. So they start to march me towards the backstage area. And if you know where it is at the Forum, it's sort of, there's a runway that goes down. So they're sort of taking me around and we're getting closer. Then all of a sudden they get a call for another security incident. So they just abandon me there. They're like, sorry, we got to go. You're out of luck. And almost as quickly as my friend had disappeared, he reappears because he's watched me being taken away. He had left the show because he was so freaked out by what happened. So he thought
that was nice of him to keep an eye on. He
thought I was being hauled away to jail.
Yeah.
So he reappears and he's completely flustered. I, of course, have just loved the whole thing. It was so comical. So that's where the story basically ends. We do a drive through and go back up to Cal Arts. So, but a few pictures did survive. But that was Duran Duran.
Yeah, that was a crazy moment. There's been boy bands that have been manufactured to get that same reaction from the female audience, similar to early Beatles, early Stones, that sort of thing.
But right.
That was like the last rock and roll band that garnered that sort of of just unbelievable attention, especially on the women's side of things.
So. And it's amazing. They're still out there playing out there all the time.
Yeah. Same. I think the guitar player is not with them these days.
Yeah. I know
the
that
original guitar player.
I know there was a time when they all were back and then another friend who's a big fan. So he sort of fills me in on their history. Yeah.
So how many, not that anyone needs this sort of education at present time, but how many different ways are there to sneak in a camera?
Oh, my God. You know, as I said, the first time it was spontaneous and the tube socks saved me. As I got more sophisticated, I started taping stuff, to my body.
Magic duct tape.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I hate to admit it, but I kind of had some pretty wide, I don't want to say bell bottoms, but I had some pretty wide pant cords that I wore probably for too long in the 80s that helped me. And then eventually I got to a point where I got an old navy coat that hung down to my ankles and I modified
an old pea coat.
I modified it so I could the equipment could hang inside of the coat and go down to basically the hem.
Yeah.
And that was fantastic because they would do the pat down and they wouldn't go below basically, you know, they wouldn't even go down to your knees.
Right.
So that was where I would hide all kinds of
getting
stuff.
Getting a little too close to the nether regions.
Right. And I would use the nether regions too. That was another area you could hide film canisters and stuff like that because they weren't going to pat you there.
Yeah. Now they got the wand. And, so there's good luck with that. So.
Well, it's funny. There's a couple of shows coming up that I have tickets to that I'm sort of contemplating trying to sneak in, see if I can get away. That I know.
Oh, so you still have the.
I want to see if
bug,
I can do
huh?
it. I want to see if I can get in the 35 millimeter.
Have you done it since then? So you're now thinking about it.
I've brought in a lot of little digital cameras to a lot of shows, and even some that you weren't supposed to photograph. But that's no big challenge. Like sometimes even those you can dump it as you're going in. You know, through you know, as they're wanding you because they're not really paying attention. It's the big rig. I want to see if I can do it one last time. So,
oh, that sounds interesting. You'll have to get back on us whether that was successful or
one of the shows I'm going with my wife, and she's like, I don't want you to get caught.
Let's not say which show it is.
No.
And if you get caught, I'll meet you at the car afterwards.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like you had a real thing for a Bay Area local band that never achieved the rock and roll dream called Eddie and the Tide.
Yes.
Yeah. So really, what do you think? Why do you think they never made it?
You know, it's again, speaking from my perspective, it's a tough
business. And why did you love them so much?
I loved them because it was kind of like the band that it was the one local band that when you went to see them, there was a huge crowd. So it felt like you were seeing a regular thing. And they actually had an album out. So you knew the songs. You know, usually when you go see a local band, you don't really know their music. You're just sort of trying to enjoy it. And there's 30 people there. They felt like a real band coming. And it just, you were sure they were going to break out.
Yeah.
You know, so it was kind of cool. It was, you know, so you could say it was like seeing, you know, the Beatles at the Cavern or you know, Springsteen at the Bottom Line. You were going to be able to have that experience. And they didn't. And why, you know, it's just, it's rock and roll. It's like, why do some hit and some don't? You know?
Yeah, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to figure that out. And, you know, and of course, you know, you've been told for decades that, you know, the Suits, oh, they've got it all figured out. Don't we know which ones are the ones to sign and which ones are the ones to leave behind? No, they don't really know either.
Yeah.
It's all a big gamble. I listened to some of the tunes because of your book, and, you know, they definitely belong in that mid-80s.
Yeah,
sort of.
They're very much a product of their time.
Yeah. A little, I can hear a little of that authentic Bruce John Mellencamp sort of, like, you know, I'm telling you the way it is, kid, sort of lyrical content, you know, a little Huey Lewis sort of thing, which again comes out of the Bay Area. So they just, you know, just for one reason or another, it just didn't happen. There's a lot of bands like that.
Yeah, they did. I think they're, and I only actually found this out because of my wife, they did have a song on the soundtrack to, oh God, what's the vampire movie that was shot in Santa Cruz?
Oh, Lost Boys.
Lost Boys, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of their peak. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think they did get a record deal, but I don't think anything came of the record they made, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think they're still out, or he's still out.
Are they?
Doing some things.
Huh. I haven't followed where they ended up after the 80s.
Google. on June 25th, 1984, at Wolfgang's in San Francisco, Outlaw photograph the greatest band in the history of rock and roll. The band that was always so far ahead of the musical curve, they were about to skid uncontrollably and crash into their very deaths. That band is Spinal Tap.
Yes, without a doubt, one of my all-time favorite
Tell us about what must be seared or maybe abused into your very soul of rock and roll.
Well, and again, this is covered in the book. If you were as obsessed with rock and roll in the 80s, you cannot underestimate what it was when this movie came out.
Oh,
it was like everything you loved
and hated, and we're like, are they talking about me?
it was just pitch perfect, and the movie had come out and was a sensation. And within a month of the movie coming out, they put together this really quick little tour where they played San Francisco and I think maybe one show in L.A., and it was just incredible. I got in to see them, got my equipment in. And
which was one of the hardest tickets to get. I think you say in the book, it's like it was unbelievable.
It was unbelievably difficult. I got in, I got my equipment in. And the show was just incredible. And you couldn't tell who was having more fun, the audience or the performers, because I'm sure they could not believe that this made-up band with this movie that had quickly become a sensation, that they were now performing live, you know, and they were loving it. And what was also interesting, because they did tour later. They did later tours.
Yeah, yeah.
But what was really unique about this—
They had to find a drummer, but sure.
Right. What was unique about this moment was that it was like they had jumped off the screen, because they looked exactly like they did in the movie. When you saw them later, there was always this weird effect where they got older, but the hair was the same because they wore the same wigs. So when you— and there's still a lot of fun, but it wasn't— I mean, this was just the movie come to life. And I remember there was a review in the paper the next day that just summed it up the best. And it said, if you miss this show, go ahead and kick yourself. Mm-hmm. It was that much fun. And adding to it also as a rock and roll photographer, when they did Stonehenge, you know, the famous Stonehenge number, there was a rock and roll photographer who in the Bay Area, who was a professional, who was well known, who was a short person. And he came out and did the dance for that. So that was special that he came out. And it was funny because he was shooting the show. I remember seeing him on the stage photographing. And then sure enough, when it came for that number, he put on the shoes and the hat and he came out and did the dance for Stonehenge.
The little people.
Right. And it was just, so that just, you know, for us in the photography crowd was extra special to see that they had chosen him to do it and he had done it.
Yeah, I believe you are going to go and see one of them tonight, Derek Smalls.
That is correct.
Who's still out on the road.
And yeah, still, you know, as he's calling it, lukewarm water live. If you remember from the film, one of them, he says one of them is fire, the other is ice, and I'm in between
lukewarm
water. Yeah. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
All right. So shooting U2 again at Bill Graham Civic, and now Bill Graham Civic,
yeah,
in 1984 changed your game. Because let's talk about you now going pro. You worked for, I think, both Artist Magazine and BAM Magazine.
Right. I shot a fair amount.
Because of this show.
Well, indirectly, what had happened was I had started, you know, as I had built up all of this guerrilla photography, as you called it, or outlaw photography, I'd built up a portfolio. So, you know, at the age of 20 or 21, I thought, well, I should do something with this. I had a portfolio and I typed up a list. And I remember I had this old typewriter that was an old mechanical that was so old that every time you hit a period, it would punch a hole in the paper. It was that old of that I used. And I typed up this list and Artist Magazine hired me and I started doing professional gigs for them.
So now you had credentials.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then from this U2 show, I took a picture at this show of Bono that I went to an open call that BAM Magazine had, and I brought my portfolio.
That's a pretty cool picture.
Yeah, it's this great picture of him pointing into the crowd. They used to do this thing where they would pull somebody up out of the crowd and give him the Edge's guitar and teach him a chord, and they would strum it, and then they would all leave and leave this person on stage. And I caught the moment where Bono was selecting the person. So I had this great picture, and I remember I had the meeting with BAM, and they're going through my book. And they're like, wow, these are great. They're great. Then they stop on the page of this photo of Bono. And they're looking at it. And it was two art directors or photo editors. And they kind of look at it and they look at each other. And then one of them turns to me and says, we did a cover on Bono a couple of weeks ago and we couldn't find a good picture. If we'd had this picture, this would have been our cover. Mm. So needless to say, they hired me on the spot. And I was now, you know, was now going to be an assignment photographer for BAM.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah. Good and bad, as we'll find out going forward. But okay, so, you know, all kidding aside about Spinal Tap, mm-hmm. Probably the biggest game changer for rock and roll in the 1980s, we have to discuss the Prince show that
yes.
you shot. You got to see the Purple Rain tour at the Fabulous Forum mm-hmm. February 24th, 1985. And I believe this is where you took your all-time favorite shot.
Yeah. This is Prince in the Purple Rain area, Purple Rain era. And this was the closest to Beatlemania that I had experienced because I was in college now and I can remember.
Even more so than the Duran Duran.
Yeah, because Duran Duran was a phenomenon with kids, but they weren't everywhere. Like, you know, like as I'm about to, like there was the one guy who was obsessed in college. when Purple Rain hit, I can remember walking through the dorm and hearing that album coming out of every room at a different place on the album. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that way with Duran Duran. People knew who they were, but it was confined. You know, it's like, no offense to them, but like One Direction or one of those where they're hitting a sweet spot. It wasn't like, you know. It
wasn't ubiquitous.
Yeah. And, you know, and right. It wasn't ubiquitous. And Prince also had the number one movie. I mean, it was, you know. So when he came to town, I was going to be damn sure to be there. And
you were going to party like it was 1999.
Exactly, and 2000. And so I remember I was so excited for the show, I bought a brand new high-power telephoto lens. And it came the night before the show, so I really didn't get a chance to do much with it. I sort of played to make sure it worked, you know, photographically. Well, the next day in the parking lot, I'm getting ready to go into the show, and I'm trying to put it in all the different places that I would hide equipment, and the lens is too darn big to fit anywhere. It's just too big of a lens. So fortunately, I had gone to this show with a female friend, and I got this brilliant idea of, this was the 1980s and women's hair was really big.
Big hair.
And she always carried with her a can of Aquanet.
Of course.
So we hid the lens in her purse under the can of Aquanet, and we went up to security. I remember walking in and the guard is sort of looking at her like, what is this
big bag and there's some cylinder in there.
Okay. So sure enough, we get up there, the guard opens it, looks in, sees the Aquanet, says, oh, fine, go on in. And I went on in and shot, like you said, some of my favorite photos, including my favorite photo ever at the Prince show.
Yeah, why is that your favorite photo?
It just, it perfectly captures Prince, and it's a moment where Prince has sort of got his hand up and he's in the classic guitar pose, about ready to make a mighty strum on the guitar. But because it's Prince, there's a big pink boa that's flowing, and I just thought that just captures who that man is.
I have to agree. It's a pretty stunning photograph.
Well, thank you. It's my favorite.
Yeah, I can see why. And you know, we just recently lost Prince, and he is. That picture is everything. It's that singular moment. And there may be others taken around that time, but right at that moment, I mean, that is the height, the peak of his powers.
Oh, no question.
And it comes across in that photograph.
Oh, so. Great. Thank you.
So was the 85 Howard Jones gig the first where you had to abide by the rules of the time for professional photography?
Yeah, it was my first arena show. I had shot other club shows, and it was the first time I shot an arena where I was in the pit and all that. And yeah, and it was very strange to walk up to an arena with my camera back over my shoulder because I knew
instead of getting turned away, you're like, yes, okay, that door over there.
Exactly. And, I went in the pit and, with the other, it was the first time I sort of met the other big Bay Area photographers, and I remember them kind of looking at me like, who's this kid?
Right?
Yeah, I'm like 20 years old. And you're only supposed to shoot three songs and they want you out of the pit. So the whole thing was just, it was weird. It was just not, I kind of missed the excitement. Well, I did miss the excitement.
There was no excitement. It was a job.
It was a job. though the later I had to shoot bands that I didn't like, and I'm not going to give any of those names. I did like Howard Jones. So at least there was the fun of that at least it was a performer I was interested in, but I certainly missed, the challenge. And, they didn't want you to shoot more than three songs. They wanted you to leave. And most of the other photographers did. I hung around and still shot a few more shots from the audience, just sort of almost for old time's sake.
But that's the first time where maybe you're beginning to think, maybe photography is not my future.
or at least not the professional aspect of the rock and roll, because it's, as I mentioned a moment ago, that when you everybody that I went to see and went to all these lengths to smuggle in the equipment were bands that I loved.
You loved them. Yeah, so the passion was there from the get-go.
Exactly. And then when it becomes bands you're not quite as interested in, it takes, and you don't have the excitement of, getting around security. Yeah, it definitely was starting to become something different.
Well, there are drugs for that. So let's talk about your William Miller from Almost Famous moment when Rolling Stone called you about your photos.
Yeah, I had shot another festival up in the mountains, shot a bunch of stuff and gotten home late at night, and about 8 o'clock in the morning, my phone...
This is Calaveras County Fair.
Yeah, right? They would have the Mountain Air Festival every year, and it was a couple hours and I'd drive up there. So I'd gotten back late the night before, and my phone rings at about 7 or 8 in the morning, and I stupidly answered it. And I hear this voice on the other side go, "This is so-and-so from Rolling Stone magazine." I sort of shoot up in bed. And she says, "We have your list here. I wanted to talk to you about some of your photographs." And it was that same list I was telling you that I had typed up with punching the hole in the paper. Mm-hmm. And this woman rattles off, you know, very business, very fast, rattles off, "We were interested in Talking Heads, Tom Petty, Huey Lewis." And I'm just sort of like writing this down. And I can tell that as the conversation is going on, she's getting more impatient because she realizes she's talking to a kid. You know, she's expecting like somebody older.
Again, you should have done the William Miller
thing. Right.
This is a William Miller.
Exactly. So she's getting more impatient, and then she starts to give me FedEx information, and I've never sent anything to anybody on FedEx before, let alone on their account. You know, so I start to
You're
say,
giving me your account? You know, I can use this.
Well, I'm more saying like, "So you want me to pay to," she's like, "No, that's the account number. We're paying for it." And then she basically
this
like,
is Rolling Stone. Get your act together.
Exactly. So basically that's where the conversation ended, and she hung up, you know, very quickly. And then I sort of was sitting there going, "Did that just happen?" And then I looked down at my notes and, you know, I had written the stuff down. So yeah, that was my encounter with Rolling Stone, and I shipped off the pictures that day.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear back from them?
I don't believe I ever heard back. It's one of those things that, you know, a lot of stuff, because this all goes back 30 years, a lot of stuff is lost in my memory. Like I was going through a lot of paperwork that I had found when I was pulling out the negatives that I'd saved. And there was stuff like that had been sent to Spin Magazine by artists, like stuff I didn't even remember that they had purchased photos, and just stuff I didn't remember. So they may have responded. I don't even remember. It's kind of been lost. I remember the story of them calling me. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I can't remember exactly what happened.
But again, another instance where I'm sure in, you know, your mind, you're beginning to say, "Is this really what I want to do?"
Well, I was thrilled by this. This was exciting. The real problem, like I said, was the calls to do shows that I wasn't as interested in, and the eventual conflict with even though this was really taking off, I was going to be a filmmaker. I'm not, you know, again, it's being young where you're like, you just do everything. You're not, you know, it didn't occur to me that, no, this is actually going pretty well, you know?
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about it earlier when we brought up the Grateful Dead, but there's that Ventura Fairgrounds show.
Yeah.
You know, and always a great place to see the Dead.
Yeah.
And during the second show, you had shot the show before, the day before.
Right.
You'd had plenty of pictures. And I totally understand what you mean in the book when you say, hey, they don't really change a lot from day to day.
Yeah.
So it's not that exciting. You're not going to get something that's going to make you go, wow, that's amazing, because it looks just like it did the day before.
Yeah.
But I'm going to assume you've done this without chemical enhancement. maybe not. More importantly, your life changes in an instant.
Yeah. There were many Dead shows with chemical enhancement, but this was not one of them. This moment happened out of it. It was the first set of the second show where I just want to put the equipment down and dance. And that really was the moment, sort of like I was pretty well on my way to being a Deadhead, but that's kind of where it all came together. Sort of when you have that first moment where you feel free enough to dance, you know, where you're in it. You know, that's one of the joys of the Grateful Dead, is that it's 10,000.
And you don't care what everybody, nobody's going to look at you.
And nobody cares themselves. Yeah, they're having a good time, you know, and that's a very freeing thing. And that's when it sort of hit me. And the whole experience of that weekend, it was, you know, I went with four friends. We slept on the beach. You know, it was all those wonderful things that go with with being young and seeing the Grateful Dead. And so it all really coalesced in that moment on that weekend for me.
And then that was basically kind of the end of outlaw photography.
Yeah, I was still doing a little more. The final incident that cinched it was something that happened at a Springsteen show, where I'll just briefly, I wasn't shooting it professionally, but I still was shooting other shows professionally. And
that was October 2nd, 1985, right? Church of Bruce.
Exactly. You know, this was a big show, and I got 20 rolls of film in, and I started photographing, and I'll sort of tell this quickly, but something happened mechanically to my camera during the show, and basically all but two rolls came out blank. I had 18 blank rolls of film, and I just went, you know what, this is...
You had done this as outlaw. You'd stuck
the this
camera.
Was an outlaw, right. Even though it wasn't a show I'd been assigned to do, and it was Springsteen, so I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll do it, you know, for fun again. And I took that as the sign that I couldn't sustain the film I was still studying film, and I was getting all these calls to shoot shows in L.A. And I said, this is it. This is the sign I've been looking for. And I pretty much hung it up after that.
Listened to the universe right there. So. Again, the Grateful Dead. You know,
it was the combination of dead shows and also
wanting Bruce
and Bruce. And I still had a few more shows left that I shot that I had assignments that I agreed to. I shot, I think, like Nick Lowe and the Untouchables and maybe Los Lobos. And they're in the book. But then after that, that was when I was done. And I pretty much I used to keep, again, they're in the book, lists of all the shows I went to. And if you looked at the pages after this, it suddenly just becomes Grateful Dead, Grateful Dead, Grateful Dead. all the other shows disappear.
Yeah. So you make the career decision.
Yeah.
No Rolling Stone magazine, no Annie Leibovitz or Mick Rock or Armand Gallo or Jim Marshall or Henry Diltz for you.
Right.
The last show as an outlaw photographer was Church of Bruce.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. I think I might have taken the equipment in to see The Dead a couple times after that just for fun, you know, in terms of as not with passes.
Well, Dead Show, you can get just about anything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's not that special.
Yeah.
The sneak stuff.
Yeah. I did. I'll just tell really a very quick little story about shooting at a Dead Show about a year or two later. I was done with all this, but we had particularly good seats, so I thought, oh, I'll bring in my equipment. So I smuggled in my equipment, and we're in about the fourth or fifth row over on Phil's side, if you remember the
I know exactly what
So I'm taking pictures over there, and I decide, well, I want to go back and get sort of a wide shot of the whole band. So I go to the back about 30 or 40 rows back, and I'm standing dead center, and I'm taking pictures, and a guard comes over to me. And you know, he's going to start hassling me. And I turn to him and say, hey, I just want to take a couple of pictures and then I'll go back to my seat. In the music, he mishears me and he says, yeah, go ahead. Go up to the front. You got 10 minutes. So I'm like, okay. So,
I'm thinking you're a credentialed
photographer. Yeah, exactly. Right, so I'm like, okay. So I go up to the front and I'm literally like, you know, up in the barrier.
Right on
like,
the rail. Right.
Right on the rail taking. And so I got, there's actually is one picture in the book from that shoot. I had to put it in because it's such a picture I like. So that was just kind of a funny incident where I wasn't even trying. And the guy was like, yeah, go ahead. So.
Well, I think I already know the answer to my next question because we kind of hit on it a couple of times. Do you miss it? So apparently you do.
Yeah, I miss it. I honestly wish I hadn't stopped. It's one of those things looking back like I should have done them both, even though it was getting hard. But, you know, you're young. I don't know. As we were saying earlier, I went to CalArts, so it was 30 miles to get into L.A. So, you know, it did
take itself. Oh, don't tell me about that.
Yeah. You know, yeah. But, no, I do regret it. I don't know. It was just one of those things that I wish I had continued with it, particularly looking back on it. But it is nice. It's been so nice to revisit all these memories and realize how fun it was.
Yeah. How did you put the book together?
Well, it kind of touches on a little bit of a sad thing. When Prince and Bowie passed away, I just put pictures.
2016.
Yeah, I just put some pictures up on Facebook to memorialize them and just, you know, because I had these pictures and all of a sudden I got inundated by all these people going, why do you have these pictures? What's the story here? And there was one person in particular, I'll throw his name out there, Andrew Diggs, who knew me at CalArts, who reminded me of some of the stories I had told him then. And, you know, back then when I was in the thick of it, you'd come in my dorm room and my pictures were everywhere. You know, they were on the wall. There were, you know, stuff was just out on the counter. So he was the one who suggested I do a book. And initially I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then when I really thought about being able to incorporate the stories and the smuggling in of the equipment, I thought, okay, that's unique. That's a different story. Mm-hmm. And so that's when it really took off. But I have him to thank. And because of Facebook, because of people going, why do you have these pictures? You know?
Yeah. Now, of course, you can't even recreate the experience, nor would you want to. But back in the day, even in the 80s, a rock concert was still thought of as a magical experience. I mean, you know, because you couldn't just everybody bring a photograph
right.
in. You know, it was incredibly special if you did have something like that. So, you know, the people on the stage are gods. The audience feels as if they're just lucky to be there. And we've hit on some of those stories personally yourself. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of our audience understands what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You know, is there any way to kind of feel like that today?
You know, I'm sure it, you know, one of the reasons that rock and roll, or I believe rock and roll has survived this long is that it reinvents itself. It means something different to each generation. You know, I'll be honest, I don't listen to a lot of contemporary music and I shouldn't in a lot of ways. It's really an art form of the young.
For the youth, right?
Yeah, and so my music made no sense to my dad, and my son's music will make no sense to me, and it kind of should be that way. So I think they're having, this generation will have its own experiences where they'll be moved by a particular show the way I was, you know? But, you know, there were things that were unique to this time that I think helped, you know, and you sort of touched on it, that one of the things was the difficulty of even finding out about tours.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like you just went on a website, you know.
You had to read the paper, and then it was like, oh my gosh,
For me, it was Rolling Stone. I mean, I would be at there was a Tower Records in Palo Alto where I grew up. That was like the hub for all rock and roll. And when that issue came out, I think it was Wednesday or whatever, I was there as soon as it hit the newsstand because you would see who was touring. I mean, that was the only way to find out. When I went to Europe to shoot those shows, I had to get,
NME.
NME, an imported copy of it. Exactly. That was it. There was no other way to find out.
Yeah. Whereas today, it's everything is available.
Google it and there you go.
In a smartphone that, everybody carries around with them.
Yeah.
So, what would you suggest to any budding photographers out there today on how to get that perfect shot when they do pull out the camera to shoot?
The one bit of advice, because I have been asked that, and that I learned
is... So they can
do
it quickly and then put it away.
Right. No, just if you want to, you know, it's like this in anything, but with rock photography, I found shoot as much as you can and shoot the, you know, don't be a snob, shoot the smaller bands, because when there's nothing at stake, because when everything's at stake, what you learned shooting the smaller bands will come back to help. Because that, you know, there's even a band in there that was, it was actually the brother of the guy who was obsessed with Duran Duran. He had a band called Haven that are also in the book that I included, that I shot them at the Troubadour at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday.
Yeah. I think there's some shots in the book.
Yeah. And that was a great, you know, it was a learning, you know, it was all part of all of it, you know? And so that's my, you know, don't turn down any chance to shoot.
You know, is your number one advice.
Yeah, and now you have no excuse. You know, back then you had to pay for processing, printing.
It was
now
expensive.
Yeah. It was. I developed my own black and white, so that made it a little cheaper. But yeah, the color was expensive.
Yeah. Well, at CalArts, I'm sure all the labs were there, and you could get in there.
Yeah, you go down and
film. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a little bit easier for you.
Yeah, although I think we had to pay for our own chemicals. I don't remember the school paying for the chemicals. You had the space, but I don't think they paid for the chemicals.
So what's up next for you, Julian?
Well, you know, as I said, I went into the film business, so I'm, you know, I've been promoting this book the last few months, and it's been great. The reaction's just been fantastic. And then, you know, my day job is my writing. I have a novel that I wrote a few years ago, very different subject, about the world of live television in the 1950s before there was videotape. Everything on TV was live, and almost all of it
like
out of...
Like a My Favorite Year sort of thing?
Exactly. Very much in the flavor of that. And that book, the book is in development to be a TV series. So that's going on. And once I get done with the promotion of this, I have another novel about Hollywood in the 1930s that I'm in the process of finishing up, and I'm hoping to have done in the next 6 months, at least a first draft.
Wow, sounds very exciting.
Yeah, well, trying to keep busy.
Well, we hope to see some of that out there. Hey, it was a pleasure having you with us today on Deeper Digs in Rock, Julian Stone.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to talk with you.
Great stories all. I'm surprised we didn't run into each other back in those heady times when rock and roll was king and every week a legendary act was coming through town.
As he and I discussed, with everyone now being an outlaw photographer with a smartphone, the allure is gone. And I think most of you would agree that is not the only thing missing in today's carefully planned slick arena shows. So, go out and grab No Cameras Allowed, My Career as an Outlaw Photographer 1981-1987 by Julian David Stone. You will not be disappointed. And I might add, going through the book many times while preparing for our discussion, he really had good taste in music. Even as a youngster, all the artists presented are pretty fucking cool and ended up being legendary. Okay, we will see you diggers out there. I am the rock and roll archaeologist Christian Swain, and this has been Deeper Digs in Rock, a Pantheon podcast. Until next time, keep up the rockin'. Hey diggers, Christian Swain here, with a short pause for a great cause. We believe music education for young people is an investment in a better future for all of us. If you listen to our podcasts, chances are you agree. Little Kids Rock has transformed the lives of more than 650,000 public school students by bringing music education into their schools. Little Kids Rock trains teachers in underfunded schools to teach kids the music they love. From the Beatles to Bruno Mars, Led Zeppelin to Lady Gaga, Chuck Berry to Chance the Rapper. Little Kids Rock has become a national movement to restore, expand, and innovate music education in public schools across America. Visit littlekidsrock.org and learn more about how you can help put music where it belongs, in our schools. Thank you, and let's keep up the rockin' right into the next generation.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Playlists can be found at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rnrap.com for more information.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.